السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسوله الكريم. أما بعد, so welcome to today's session that is being brought to you by Sapience Institute. Today we're going to be talking about a topic that is very near and dear to me, and the topic is beauty and the recognition of God. Now, as we get started, we want to talk a little bit about the world that we live in. And before I get to our first slide here, one of the things that we have to understand about, when we talk about topics like beauty and what we call more like fitri topics, is that they present a certain angle that many times we don't think about, because we live in a world that is, perhaps some would say, overly focused on rationality. And so this topic, I think what will happen, if you haven't seen it in the past, that I think you may be pleasantly surprised with the information that we're going to be presenting today, inshallah. So with that said, let's go ahead and start in earnest. I wanted to start with us with this particular tweet that was sent out by Rick Enfield. And he says that we're in a post-truth world with eroding trust and accountability. It can't end well. Now, we want to ask the question, why would someone like Nick Enfield post a tweet where saying that, look, we're living in a world that's post-truth? Because the reality is, when we start reflecting upon the world that we live in, we see that the things that are happening around us, whether that's in the political sphere, whether that's in the social sphere, economic sphere, there is a lot of upheaval when it comes to the idea of truth. Okay, so when we're talking about, let's say, social media, you find that across social media there is a type of mistrust, and because of that mistrust, there are real world consequences that come about. Okay, so that mistrust would do what has to do with things like not trusting the government, not trusting scientists, not trusting religious leaders, and so on and so forth. So what Rick Enfield here is highlighting is that we live in a post-truth world with eroding trust and accountability. It can't end well, because if we continue down this path, and he's thinking about this in terms of like a global community, if we go down this path and there's no trust in anything, it's going to be very problematic. And we saw some of the ramifications of that mistrust, at least locally here in the US, when the Capitol was stormed. And you found that people were storming the Capitol because they mistrusted the electoral system here in the US. Now, that's a real world consequence to a form of mistrust. Now, so when we think about this, what we find is that this mistrust has proliferated in this day and age substantially more than it ever has before. Okay, and that has a lot to do with the internet itself. There's a very good documentary that I saw recently on Netflix. I think it was called the social order, the social paradox, or something like that. And what they highlighted is that when a person gets online, and many of us spend a lot of time online, when a person gets online, there are a team of engineers that are behind the scenes that are, you know, basically working with algorithms, taking in all the data they've collected on you as an individual. And by way of that data, they are now, you know, feeding information to you as a specific individual. In other words, they make a what's kind of called an avatar, a personality type or trait for you as an individual. And then when you let's say search for something on Google, the search isn't the same across the board. Rather, it's curated for you individually. Now, you may think, okay, well, what's wrong with that? Well, the problem is that is casting the idea of something being objectively true. It's casting that aside, in the sense that if you were to search, like we have in the slide here, climate change is, Now, based on all the algorithms and everything and all the data that's collecting about you, your Google search result could come up as climate change is a hoax. Climate change is disrupting the planet. Or it could come up as climate change is the greatest threat. Climate change is natural. All of that. Now, who cares? Like, okay, so now you've got all of this information. They have all this information on you. Is that for your benefit as an individual? And the answer is no, because the end user is in fact not you, but people that pay for the ads that are able to fund the companies like Google and Facebook where they can make money. So it's a very materialistic goal at the end. Now, this goal, because it's based in this type of materialism, you are not the end user. So your idea of let me search for something that is true and let's say objectively true or that's neutral, let's say, that you want to have a search term, it's neutral, it just comes up, you know, the search items come up in some sort of a neutral way, it doesn't happen. Why is that? Well, because an avatar of you is built and it's constructed based on all the information, and therefore you and perhaps your neighbor are getting two different types of information. Now, again, what we see is that in that sort of environment, you have a lot of news that is false. And in fact, there was a study done recently from MIT, and they concluded that false news travels 6 times faster on Twitter than truthful news. And that is phenomenal when you think about it. Right? One of the research quotes I have here from the study said, accurate stories rarely reach more than 1,000 people, yet the most prominent false news items routinely reach between 1,000 and 100,000 people. Okay, so the world we live in and our sources of information, if we're spending a lot of time online, there may be a mistrust from the source that we're getting the information from. Okay, and what we find, like I have on the slide here, that you look at people who study societies, civilizations, and they see this as a downward trajectory, because as people start to get misinformation and mistrust starts to proliferate across society, you find a breakdown of society. And so, like this article on The Atlantic, the author Yanni Applebaum, he mentions, you know, the title is captivating because it's how America ends. And in a sense, he's saying, how does Western civilization end? Because of this proliferation of misinformation that is causing people to mistrust various facets of sources of information, right? Whether that be source of information like scientists and to mistrust the entire scientific enterprise, whether that has to do with government and mistrusting local state, national governments, or that has to do with mistrusting religion and religious leaders. So across the board, if there is a culture of mistrust, then it becomes very difficult for society to bind together. And you find that this is something that you know, authors like journalists like Yoni Applebaum are mentioning, that this is something that can cause to a breakdown of society at its core. Now, you might be asking, why have I started with, you know, on a topic on beauty, why have I started with all of this, all of these concepts of mistrust? Because the thing is, when people think about the information that they're getting, people assume that they are able to take in information in a completely unbiased way, generally, right? And more or less that may be true. But the assumption, and we've seen this with the information that's available online and how online activity and our engagement online can actually have an influence on how we think and the opinions we form, we see that that idea of us forming rational conclusions to reach truth is impeded. Okay? And so, based on, you know, just what we've presented so far, we find that when someone wants to find the truth about something, a simple Google search won't lead to the truth directly, because there are a number of factors that one needs to consider. You know, the background of the engineers, what is the motivation of the search engine you're using? What is the motivation of Facebook when you're just, you know, perusing through and looking for friends that you haven't spoken to in a while? Like, what are the motivations behind all of these, you know, all of these social media, you know, things that we're engaged with. So if the idea is that our information can be tainted, and us, in order for us to reach truth, it cannot be just a rational endeavor, meaning we can't just trust our own, you know, cognitive sense to reach truth 100% of the time. And I don't think anyone even expects that. So with this, you can say this depreciation of the ability to gain information and see truth as truth, one of the things that we understand, at least from the Islamic framework, is that the paths to truth are not just rational. Now, notice that it said not just rational. I'm not saying that we're discounting rationality altogether, but I'm saying that there are paths to truth. When if we're thinking about truth as being objective and being true, if that's the case, then there are paths to truth that there are paths to truth that are not just limited to the rational mind, right? And not just information coming in and so on and so forth. So one of those paths to truth, and this is what the central thesis of this particular session is beauty and one's exposure to beauty. So as you'll notice, the central thesis is the greater your exposure to beauty, the greater your ability to see truth as it really is. In other words, when a person, what the thesis is trying to focus on is that when a person has exposure to beauty, when they're able to witness beauty, there's a certain phenomena where a person is able to recognize something to be true. Okay. Now, why am I stating that this is the central thesis? Well, why do I say that? That's what we're going to be discussing as we move forward. The greater your exposure to beauty, the greater your ability to see truth as it really is. Okay. Let's start with some basics about yourself. Okay, so we talked about social media, the mistrust of the government, the mistrust of scientists, and so on and so forth. And we may come back to that in a second here. But let's start with our very own selves. I mean, you can definitely trust yourself, right? I mean, you have a first-person experience. You study things. You have information that you're taking in. And if that's the case, you should be able to make rational conclusions based on true information that itself is true. Well, let's dig down a little bit deeper into that. All right. So, can you trust yourself? There was what you would call an anthropologist, I think, by the name of Franz Müller-Lyer, and back in the 1800s, and he came up with this famous line optical illusion. Okay. Now, most people, when they see this diagram that you see on the slide, they seem to look at the line on the right, the one with the two lines going out like a Y on the top and the bottom. They see that central line to be longer than the line on the left, the line that has the arrow type shape on both ends. Now, that's what we see, and the reality is that in fact they're of equal length. Now, this optical illusion was quite popular starting from the time when Franz Müller-Lyer introduced it. And this would be introduced to people. They would see it and they say, yes, most people, and maybe you're looking at it and saying, okay, well, I don't see it, but you would be in the minority, right? Most people, when they see these lines, it seems like the line on the right is longer than the line on the left. And in reality, they're actually the same length. Now, this optical illusion was taken to be something that was true across the board, and various factors, when they were studied, they were attributed to just a certain type of, let's say, cognitive misstep in the brain. But what happened was in the 1960s, the researchers broadened their experimentation, because what they realized is from the 1800s until the 1960s, all of the people that were that were shown this diagram in terms of official research were what they call weird. Now you might be wondering, what do you mean by weird? Like how does that? What do you mean they're weird? So what I mean by weird is that cultural psychologists, this is a term that they used when they're trying to categorize the group of people that they are researching. Okay, so cultural psychologists, they use this acronym WEIRD to mean white, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic societies. So all the people that have been exposed to this particular optical illusion were all weird based on the acronym. So in the 1960s, researchers decided to show this very optical illusion to people across the world. And they gathered about 2,000 people, and they basically had them look at, you know, had small samples from each part of the world, parts from North Africa, you know, South Asia, Southeast Asia, Australia, etc. And what they found was very fascinating, because what they found in that 1960 study was that many, many people did not see the optical illusion at all. And that a lot of that was based on the geographical area that they were coming from. So for instance, when they looked at the small samples from the Suku tribes people in northern Angola, this was a specific area that they had gotten a sample of people to look at the optical illusion, and the Biti tribes people from the Ivory Coast, no one in that group saw the lines as being different or of a different length. Now, when this was quite surprising to the researchers, because they started to now wonder, why is it the case that you, when your sample group is weird, right? That they're coming from the West, they're educated, industrialized, etc. That most, by and large, people from that, you know, that section of society, that section of that culture, sees these lines as being of different lengths. Yet people from those specific tribes don't see the difference at all. And so one of the theories that was presented was that it has to do with our depth perception based on the architecture that we find ourselves in, right? So when you think about the Western world or those places that have been influenced by the Western world, we find, especially in modernity, right? When we think about architecture, and many people say that, you know, that the death of beauty happened with modernity, specifically in the realm of architecture, because architecture started to map out this worldview that had to do with giving preference to utility over beauty. And so hence, when you walk into a certain room within the Western world or those countries that have been influenced by the Western world, you find angular, straight, structures. And you look in the diagram there, you see that those angles, you say wall A and wall B, and they have certain angles, lines are straight, walls are straight, and everything is very straight. And because they're straight, your mind then gives you a certain type of depth perception. So even when you see the lines as a vacuum without, you know, seeing them as the corners, two corners of a room, and you sense depth perception, you see the lines as being of a different length because of that sort of cognitive bias that you have being brought up in the Western world or being brought up in a part of the world that's influenced by the West. Yet when the small samples from the Suku tribes people and the Biti tribes people, when they were presented with this, when they're presented with that optical illusion, they saw the lines as perfectly the same length. And the theory was that because when they looked at where they were living, the structures that they were living in, so they were living in huts that were round. They hadn't been exposed to modernity. They hadn't been exposed to these, you know, angular structures that, you know, form part of the modern world and definitely part of the Western world. And because of that, they were not exposed to the same optical illusion that someone living in those type of structures would be exposed to. So the reason I'm mentioning this study is because we have to ask ourselves that if it's true that we, you know, that we can take in information, is it that we can take in information in a completely unbiased way? When the reality is there are many cognitive biases that we're exposed to. And of course, one may reason that we know about these lines because of information from other senses. So yes, maybe optically, we have a cognitive bias here, but we're able to do away with that cognitive bias by way of other senses, like measurements and rulers and things like that. And no doubt that's true. But the reality is you still have an initial cognitive bias, whereas, you know, the Suku tribes people and the Bidi tribes people don't have the cognitive bias. So you, at least we'd have to say, when it comes to the question of can we trust ourselves, we can say it's not 100%. We cannot trust ourselves 100% of the time. We are going to have cognitive limitations. There are going to be cognitive biases when we take in information. And that is, you can say that's exacerbated when the sheer, you know, the sheer quantity of information is so overbearing, like it is today, when by the fact that we have access to the internet, which gives us such a quantity of information that times, you know, pre-modern people that lived in pre-modernity or pre-modern times were never exposed to that sheer quantity of information. It just means that our cognitive biases are going to be greater just by the fact that we have more information. Okay. So we understand that from at least to some extent, we can't trust ourselves. What about the idea that, okay, if we have cognitive biases, then perhaps what we can do is one of the ways to expand our cognitive limitations is by getting information from other people, other sources, right? So we may have certain limitations in our knowledge, let's say in a certain field. Let's say biology or medicine. Now, we have a certain limitation, and yet we have the reality of getting sick. And how do we extend our cognitive limitation? Well, we go to a doctor, and we put our trust on that doctor's knowledge. And so, therefore, we're, in a sense, extending our cognitive limitation by basically going to the doctor, asking the doctor what's wrong, and we trust their knowledge. And so, our cognitive biases or limitations, you can say we're trying to do away with those by trusting information from other sources. Okay. And whether, you know, and this is true no matter what sort of field that you're in. Because we, as even when we think about ourselves as individuals, we rely on testimonial knowledge. We rely on the say-so of others in order to get information. Otherwise, you would not find progress, and I say that in with inverted commas, you wouldn't find technological and scientific progress if we just said we're only going to trust ourselves. We would have to deal with our own cognitive biases, but B, we would have a cognitive limitation with being, I only trust information for myself. And nobody functions like that. All of us take in information from other sources in order to expand our cognitive limitations. But now here's the thing. If we understand that we have cognitive biases, the people and the sources that we're taking information from, they too probably have cognitive biases. So we find that the issue does not necessarily get resolved, and perhaps in certain cases may be exacerbated. All right, so let me give an example of what I mean. Can we trust others? And the fact that they would have their own cognitive biases. So what you see on the screen now is a map of the world. And typically, you know, if you open any sort of book on geography, this is the map that would be presented to you. So you find you have North America being on the top part of the map. You have South America being on the bottom part of the map. Again, you have Europe on the top part of the map, and Russia, Asia, China, India being north of the equator, or parts of it being north of the equator, and of course Africa, Australia, so on and so forth, being south of the equator or being on the bottom part of the map. Now, what I'd like us to do just for a few moments here is to focus on not the concept of north and south in terms of global positioning, but rather a direction. In other words, up and down. Okay. Now, here's the thing, that when we look at the modern map, that when we look at the map today, this map is actually traced back to the Greek astronomer Ptolemy. And what we find is that Ptolemy, being an astronomer, drew the map with Europe being on top. He's Greek, and so one of the, you know, when people who specialize in cartography or map making, when they analyzed kind of the history of where we get the map of today, they found that they traced it back to Ptolemy, more or less, and they reasoned that why is it that Ptolemy placed Europe on the top part of the map and placed kind of everything else, at least at that time, you just had Europe, Africa, and parts of Asia, and perhaps the Middle East. That was kind of the known world at the time, that he placed those on the bottom. Well, one of the people that explored this area, one of the cartographers, you know, those people who make maps and study, you know, the construction of maps, they linked this to the idea, to actually a theological idea, right? That over time, well, not necessarily just a theological, but an idea based on power dynamics, right? So if you consider something to be higher, to be better, right? So that on top, that thing that's on top is going to be better. Okay, so from that perspective, if you're going to draw a map and you're going to draw your place of residence, you're going to draw it on top. Again, we're talking directional, not geopositioning here. You're going to draw on your map, draw that particular place, your place of residence, to be on top, because the idea is that you are in a position of superiority. Now, in fact, it also has a theological link, because for quite some time, the Catholic Church had this concept ingrained within their theology that things that are good, and they give kind of a moral qualification to certain things. Things that are good in terms of a sense of morality would be lighter and higher and ethereal. In other words, that they raise up. And so when they think about things that are evil and bad, they focus on those things that are in the core of the earth. So from one perspective, the hellfire would be at the core and the center of the earth. In fact, in one writing, which actually escapes me right now, but it was part of a study that was done out of the University of Berkeley. The historians analyzed not modern day Catholics, but those that come before modernity, part of the Catholic Church, they had categorized certain vegetables and certain fruits on this moral scale. So fruits or vegetables that you dig out of the ground, you take out of the ground, had more of a negative kind of evil sense to them. So things like potatoes and carrots, whereas things that were found on trees were considered of a moral, of a better, had a higher moral weight. In other words, they were morally better, right? They were good, okay? Now, so when it comes to maps, perhaps after Ptolemy, why this map was adopted in this particular way and stayed like this or continued like this in Europe and so on and so forth until it reaches us today, perhaps could be tied to Ptolemy's actual residence, and further from there could be tied to certain elements of Christian theology. That being the case, the position isn't something that's necessarily, let's say, objectively true. Okay? Why do I say that? Because when you look at cartographers out of the Muslim world, for example, Muhammad al-Idrisi, 12th century geographer, cartographer, you'll notice on the map that's there, he actually drew it from our modern day perspective upside down. So what does he do? He places, obviously, he places Mecca in the middle, and then he places, let's say, Yemen and parts of Africa and so on and so forth on top. And he places Europe, right, Spain and so on and so forth, on the bottom. Why does he do this? It has to do with his worldview. From his worldview, those things that are better, that have more, you can say, that are superior, obviously Mecca being one of them, and, you know, Yemen and so on and so forth, that he puts them on top. Now, the thing is, which map is correct? Like, if we were to say, okay, well, I want to know what's the truth of the matter. Which map do I now say that is truth? I mean, obviously, we're not saying that there's there's some sort of legal or theological weight to, you know, picking one or the other, but one does ask the question, which one is based in truth, which one's based in reality? And the thing is that we ask the question, is north always up? Imagine if you were to travel to outer space, would you see north as being up or would you see North as being down? And the reality is, because there's no anchor in outer space, there is no right or wrong answer to this question. And so, like I have on the diagram here, depending on where you are, you know, you could be, you know, upside down, you could be right side up, but then upside down and right side up are all based on some sort of an anchor, a positional anchor by which you can say that this is true and this, you know, this is right and this is wrong, this is north and this is south, or this is up and this is down. But up and down are based on a certain position having a certain anchor. If you're in outer space, well, there is no, like, there's no specific anchor. You know, you don't have gravity to rely upon out there. Yes, maybe from the moon in a specific area, but even depending on where you're on the moon. So the picture that you see up there, actually, it's a bit difficult to see, but in fact, it is almost from our from the maps that we're used to. It's actually upside down, right? Okay, so now the idea of can you trust others, we see that it's not just a matter of can you trust others because they have some sort of, you know, they're giving information based on some sort of malice, but they have cognitive limitations themselves and they have cognitive biases themselves, like those biases that become manifest, whether you're Ptolemy or you're Muhammad al-Idrisi. Depending on your background, your worldview, those biases become manifest. Now, is one or the other true? Again, that there's no right or wrong answer there. The point is that when we say, can we trust others? Again, when we are extending our cognitive limitations by trusting others, we also are subject to their own cognitive biases. So if you can't trust yourself 100%, your own cognition, your own ability to take in information, and you can't trust others, what is a person supposed to do? Especially in this day and age with the overwhelming, you know, sheer quantity of information. And this is where I'll remind us of our central thesis. And that is, the greater your exposure to beauty, the greater your ability to see truth as it really is. Because what we need to understand is that while rationality is an amazing tool, but it is not the end all and be all, right? There has to be something else that gets us to see truth as it really is. And what I'm proposing is that one of those tools is a person's exposure to beauty. Okay. Now, one of the questions we want to ask is that, is beauty part of our meta language? Now, what do I mean by this? You see, when we look at you know, the structure of our language, when we think about terms that we use within our own, you know, conversation, our communicative ability, we find that there are certain terms, and specifically here we're talking about ethical terms, that are evaluative in nature, and certain terms that are descriptive in nature. So in Izutsu's book, Ethical Religious Concepts in the Quran, he actually says that ethical terms, and specifically we're talking about ethical terms, terms like, you know, generosity, humility, that they can be either of, on a primary level or a secondary level. If those terms are on a primary level, they are primarily descriptive. They're describing something. And if they're on a secondary level, they're evaluative. In other words, primary words that are describing a certain ethic are reliant upon secondary words. They use that as the basis. So if you think about the concept of generosity, all right, so when you say, okay, well, generosity is good. So generosity is your primary descriptive term. If you talk about a person, that person is generous. And good is your secondary evaluative term, right? The term that's going to give you an evaluation. What about generosity? Well, it's good, okay? Humility, again, it's a primary term. The secondary term here is good. Humility is good. Now, the question that we want to ask when it comes to, you know, when it comes to our language is the concept of beauty, is that also part of our meta language? Now, when I say meta language, typically when you hear the term meta, it has to do with kind of the basis or the anchor for something, right? So when you think of like meta ethics, So what is the ethics built upon? What is that thing that's stable, that's built upon? What is the anchor? So what is the anchor for language itself? What is the meta language? So if we talk about something like good, and we have these three things here that are presented, why do you believe in X? Well, I believe in X because it's true. True then becomes part of our meta language. It's secondary in its nature. It's evaluative. Why do you want Y? Well, because it's good. Okay, again, we find that the term good is part of our meta language. And there's not too much, you don't find too many people arguing about this. But then when you ask the question, why do you look at Z? And you say, because it's beautiful. Is beautiful part of our meta language? Does it fall in the category of secondary evaluative terms? Or is it descriptive? Well, many people from time immemorial, you can say, actually considered beautiful to be part of our meta language, part of that evaluation that you would have. Now, where the difference comes in, or where the problems may arise, is because someone may say, well, hold on a second, but isn't beauty subjective? Like, I could look at a painting and someone else could look at a painting and I could think it's beautiful, and someone else could think that it's the ugliest thing they've ever seen. So if beauty is subjective, can we really say that it would form part of our meta language? Now, I'm going to hang that question in abeyance, this idea of subjective and objective, right? Like, is beauty in the eyes of the beholder, or are there things that are actually beautiful in a straight objective way? We're going to hang that question, we'll turn back to it. But it's something that I like to think about, that many, for instance, St. Thomas Aquinas, he attributed the idea of beauty to be part of our meta language. And that had to do with his idea that these are attributes of God, and therefore they are part of our meta language because they form the anchor, because God is our anchor, right? So God is true. Right, he's and even from an Islamic worldview, we say God is al-haq, he's the truth. So that can form part of our meta language. Similarly, God is al-bar, from again the Islamic position. Therefore, we can use good as a part of our meta language. From the Islamic standpoint, God is jameel, he's beautiful, and he loves beauty, and therefore we can use beauty as part of our meta language. Now, that being said, we said that we attributed that to St. Thomas Aquinas. And hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. I'm not sure, but his name. But there is a similar concept that the scholar Ibn al-Qayyim al-Jawzi expounds upon. And he talks about this idea of matching some of the attributes and the qualities of Allah, of God, right? And it's not that we're trying to be like God in some sort of absolute or in terms of the essence of God. But rather, we find that God has certain attributes, and the emulation of those attributes, understanding that we will fall far short than their perfection or their maximum perfection, is a clear understanding, but we still strive for them. So Ibn al-Qayyim mentions that one of the names of God is, he is al-Alim. He is the one that's all-knowing, and he loves for his creation, his slaves, the human beings, to possess knowledge. Similarly, God is al-Hakim. He is the wise, and he loves for his servants and his slaves to have wisdom. He is the one who is ar-Rahman, and so he is someone who loves for his slaves, loves for his creation, the human beings, to have mercy. Rahman means the most merciful, and so on and so forth. And similarly, we find that he is al-Jamil, and so he loves to see beauty that's manifest upon the human being. So from that perspective, we could put forth the idea that beauty could be part of our meta language. But again, we've got that issue, especially when we consider it attached to something that transcends the human being, that being God, but we still have the issue of beauty being subjective versus beauty being objective, which I said I'll touch upon in a little bit. Now, when we talk about the question of beauty being part of our meta language, there's another, secondary question. or another secondary issue from an Islamic theological point of view, and that is beauty part of our fitra? Now, I'm going to digress here just for a minute, just in case that you haven't heard some of the other Sapiens sessions on the fitra, or you haven't read Jamie Turner's article regarding the fitra. It's a great article. I highly encourage you to go to the Sapiens Institute website and have a read. You will thoroughly enjoy it, inshallah. At least I did. So I'm going to digress here just for a second, because I think it's important for us to understand and for us to kind of take the point home about beauty being part of the meta language, but even deeper than that. So as a quick, for us to quickly understand, and we'll understand our cognitive limitations as well when we understand the idea of the fitra. So let's start off with rationality as a concept. And again, I'm going to try to cover this quickly. If I miss something or something like that, there is plenty of content that we have and more content that's coming out where we dig very deep into the concept of the fitra. So let's talk about rationality for a second. When people think about rationality, they generally divide rationality into two categories. They say you have certain things that are rational and certain things that are irrational. Okay, so an irrational statement is something like, I am Fahad. Straightforward, rational statement. An irrational statement is something like, I have seen a square circle. Now, the first statement is very clear, it's rational, it makes sense. The second statement, you may come to me and say, hold on a second, what do you mean you've seen a square circle? Like, square circle doesn't make any sense, because by definition, a square is something that has four sides. And by definition, a circle is something that is round and lacks having sides. So you're saying you have something that has sides and doesn't have sides at the same time? Well, that's not rational at all. That's irrational. What if I was obstinate and I said, no, I believe in square circles? You may then present to me the specific logical principle to say, no, those things that you're speaking about are mutually exclusive. It goes against the principle of mutual exclusivity. In other words, mutual exclusivity means you have two terms that cannot exist at the same time. It cannot be Fahad and not Fahad at the same time. What if I come now and say, well, I don't believe in that principle, unless you prove to me that principle is true? Now, the problem is you can't prove the principle. You start with the principle. And so when we think about rationality, we understand that rationality as an endeavor cannot exist unless there are things that are outside of rationality that we cannot prove, but we must assume, right? And they're not irrational, but they lie outside of rationality. In fact, we call them suprarational. And so logical principles are part of the suprarational. So, and when in Islamic parlance, when we're understanding rationality as this sort of these three categories of rationality, the super rational, rational, and irrational, we could say that the super rational is what we call the fitra in Islamic parlance. So one, we understand that logical principles form part of the super rational. We understand also, though, that concepts of beauty also form part of the fitra. Now, what does the term itself mean? Very quickly, the term from an Arabic point of view, or from, let's say, the Islamic worldview, the term fitra is that state in which God has created the human being. It's that primordial base state, that is good, and that is natural. And so, therefore, the fitra is that which God has created the human being upon. So the Quran mentions this very clearly. Fitratullahi allati fatara an-nas alayha. It is the fitra that God has created the human being upon. Now, without getting into too many details about that, there's a lot we can get into, but understanding that our perception of beauty would be part of that, like, from, if we're going to look at the terminology we're using right now, the super rational or the fitra. Why? because questions about beauty are not questions that are necessarily rational. In fact, they're not rational. If you were to go out and to see a sunset with your significant other, and you turn to your significant other and say, "Wow, that sunset's beautiful," and your significant other turns to you and says, "That is the ugliest thing that I've ever seen. Prove to me rationally that that is beautiful." Well, there's nowhere you can go. Much like there's nowhere you can go if someone says, "Prove to me the logical principle." So you've got to have, by necessity, certain items that are outside of rationality that you cannot prove, but you know are true, right? And we can extend this out to things like your own existence. You can't prove that. You can't prove, for instance, the existence of other minds. You may be able to convince yourself of the existence of your mind by way of your first person experience, but the existence of other minds, how can you prove that, right? And so on and so forth. Now, because if you were to ask for proof for, let's say, even the principle or proving everything, the problem is the only place that you would be left to go to is skepticism. And you'd have, because there's no theorem that is infinitely defendable. You can't say because this forever. Because if you say that, it means you're saying, "I doubt everything." And if you're saying you doubt everything, you have to doubt your doubt, which leaves you intellectually paralyzed. I remember someone had given the example to say rationality is an amazing tool, but it still needs something outside of itself to actually work. It's much like someone who comes to you and says, "I have the perfect solvent." So someone that says, I can use my rationality to prove anything by way of proof. In other words, I can prove it, is like someone who says, "I have this solvent, this thing that can dissolve things, and it is the perfect solvent. It will dissolve anything," right? "I can prove anything. This solvent can dissolve anything." Well, you want to ask that person, what bottle will you keep it in? Because even though if you have the absolute solvent and it may be a great tool, you still need a bottle to keep it in. And that bottle is going to be absolute, that which is not soluble, that which is not solvable, right? You cannot solve it when we're talking about rationality, that which is not soluble. Anyhow, so you always need an absolute as part of your structure, something that you cannot prove, but you must assume moving forward. Now, is beauty part of the fitrah? And we would say that beauty is indeed part of the fitrah because it is not a particular concept that you're trying to prove. And in fact, we're going to get into some more details related to that as well. All right. Before we get into analyzing beauty, whether it's part of the fitrah, and then going back to our thesis about beauty and the exposure to beauty giving us access to the truth, or allowing us to see truth as it really is, I found in a book by Roger Scruton called Beauty, a very short introduction, he presents certain platitudes. Now notice, he doesn't present these as axioms, he doesn't present these as first principles, but they're platitudes. And so there may be some opinion related to this, but I think it's a good starting point. So when we are conceptualizing beauty, we're trying to understand beauty, we see that number one, one of his platitudes is that beauty pleases us. When you are looking at something, one of the reasons why you're looking at it is because there's a certain type of pleasure. And we're not talking about a physical, visceral pleasure, but this pleasure is of a different nature. So it's pleasing, but it has a different sort of content than something that would be, which we'd attribute to like a physical pleasure. Okay. Number two, one thing can be more beautiful than another. So you may be able to see one painting and compare it to another painting and say, okay, well, this one is more beautiful than this one. So there is this ability to be able to compare things and give things a value on the scale of beauty. Number three, beauty is always a reason for attending to the thing that possesses it. Okay. When you see something that's beautiful, your attention is drawn there because of the beauty, because of the content of the beauty that's there. Beauty, number four, beauty is the subject matter of a judgment, the judgment of taste. Okay, so the idea that's being put forth here is that when you are exposed to something that is beautiful, there's going to be a judgment involved. Is it beautiful? How beautiful is it? Etc.
And that has to do with the concept of taste. You have a certain aesthetic taste. You say, I like this or I don't like that. And this gets back to our concept of subjective versus objective, right? Like, is all beauty subjective, or is there some of this objective? For that beauty that's subjective, we could say it's a matter of aesthetic taste or some sort of taste that a person has. Much like the judgment of food. When you would have certain types of food that you eat, you may like them and person number two may not. And you may be able to categorize food in certain foods that you like versus certain foods that you don't like in terms of that physical phenomena of taste, that experience of taste by way of your the sense perception of the tongue. Okay, number five, the judgment of taste is about the beautiful object, not about the subject's state of mind. So when you make a judgment about taste, and here we're talking about taste being related to beauty, you're making a judgment about the object. You're not making a judgment based on the subject's state of mind, meaning you're not looking at, let's say, the painter's state of mind, right? You're looking at what the output is. And number six, nevertheless, there are no secondhand judgments of beauty. And this, I think, is really interesting because if you've ever had a conversation with someone about a particular thing being beautiful and they disagreed with you, there's no way to win that argument, right? And so there's no secondhand judgments about beauty because that is for you to make that almost direct interpretation. Okay, now one of the things that we need to understand is that when we experience beauty, it has a connection to meaning. Now remember, when we started off, I said that, you know, that we talked about cognitive biases and cognitive limitations. And while rationality is a great tool to judge whether something is true or not, we need other things to be able to understand the truth of kind of in its entirety. Okay. And so when we think about truth as an endeavor, we have to understand that the idea of meaning is very important to this journey that we're going to be taking to find truth, okay? And so one of this section, when we're talking about conceptualizing beauty, what I'm trying to do is connect beauty to meaning, meaning that there is, when we think about beauty and we think about the phenomenology of beauty, we see that it has a connection to meaning. It points to something that's deeper than just a sort of a cold cerebral sensation, right? There has to be something more. Okay, and I'm going to do that by citing a few examples. So if you see the picture on the screen right now, we see that you have a dining table that's set. Now, there is a difference when you set up a dining table for a certain purpose. Or you set up a dining table with the purpose of beautifying it. These are two different phenomena, okay? So what I've got up here is aesthetic versus utilitarian interest. If you are just focused on the utility, in other words, you're just setting up the table so that people can conveniently eat, you might take out some paper plates, put it in a stack, put on a couple of dishes and so on and so forth, and people could just directly take the food and the paper plates and you call it a day. But yet when someone sets a table, we understand that they are transcending just the idea of utility. Like if you look at the picture here, you see there are a lot of things that you may consider from a utilitarian viewpoint superfluous. You've got the candles, you've got the greenery, you've got the glass, the napkin, and how it's laid. And so what you experience is something that's beyond just the practicality of serving food, all right? So why would you set a table like that? Because as a person who's hosting a dinner, you may consider that it's a reflection of you. It's a reflection of your taste. It's a reflection of how much you care for the other person. So when you transcend mere utility, you are saying something about yourself and you're saying something about your guest. And so there's a deeper meaning to the aesthetic setting of a table versus just the utility. And so we see that beauty is connected to meaning when we compare the aesthetic to, you know, when we think of aesthetic interest versus utilitarian interest. So we see the first connection of beauty to meaning is that which says something about the person that's, let's say in this example, setting the table, and about how much that person cares about the person they're inviting over. Okay. Let's take a look at art versus entertainment. Now, I've been told many times to keep my comic book references to a minimum. And so this will be the only slide related to any sort of reference to comic books or comic book characters, superheroes, or anything like that. Beauty is connected to meaning. We said that that points to something deeper. And we can see this when we find the difference between art and entertainment. Okay? When we are discussing art, we're discussing something that goes beyond just a fleeting sensation of being entertained. Okay? And the example that I have up there is that I get into a conversation with a certain person, which will go unnamed, and we discuss Marvel versus DC. Okay? So if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's okay. DC is a type of comic book. They have their own characters. And Marvel is a type of comic book. They have their own characters. Now, one of the things about Marvel characters and Marvel movies is that they are very entertaining. So if I'm going to go and watch a Marvel movie, I'm going, you know, solely for the entertainment factor, that I get the pleasure of watching, you know, the action scenes and things like that, and then I'm done. When it comes to DC characters like Batman, let's say, there's a whole depth behind the character. There's a backstory. His, you know, parents were killed, and that's what, you know, prompted him to become a superhero, and blah blah blah, and all these other things, and all of that is being captured in the form of how the story is being told, and within the cinematography, the darkness of the shot, and so on and so forth, and all of that is an artistic expression that has to do with meaning. Because when someone is trying to put forth a type of artistic expression, again, it's saying something about the artists themselves, and it's saying something about the output, that when you're engaged with this particular type of film, or you're engaged with this particular type of painting, or you're engaged with this particular type of, you know, whatever it might be, that you're going to now think about things on a level that's deeper, that's beyond just the action sequence. Right, so we find that when it comes to the when we compare art versus entertainment, art entertainment is merely kind of touching our sensual buttons, for lack of a better phrase. Whereas art is pushing us to think about things deeper. So certain movies that you watch, they're you know, the story is very deep. The way that the story is portrayed on screen, every single shot has a certain meaning. And every single shot, the reason why they take the shot from that particular angle means something. So because of the director or the filmographer is in the position to say, okay, well, we want this angle with this lighting and so on and so forth to give people a feeling of X. That has to do more with an artistic expression as opposed to just merely entertaining people. So when we compare art versus entertainment, we see again that the focus on beauty is pointing towards something deeper and pointing towards something of meaning, of significance. By the way, that's not to say that Marvel movies are insignificant. All right. Let's give one more example. And hopefully to take the point home about beauty being connected to meaning because it points to something deeper. And we're talking, and in this slide, we're talking about prose versus poetry. Now, prose is something that you're going to read for the sake of information, right? And I have up there an organic chemistry textbook. Now, for those of you who have studied organic chemistry or are, you know, thinking that they might go to medical school or whatever it might be, whatever purpose you're studying organic chemistry, I think we can pretty much agree that when you get a organic chemistry textbook and you read through it, it's not something you're going to come back to for any other purpose except to get the information, extract the information, and perhaps to just pass the exam that you have to take to move forward. So you're really, it's just, again, it's very cold and cerebral. It's just extract information and move on. You don't return back to it. In fact, you know, for those of you who have gone, you know, past your undergraduate level, maybe your doctors, whatever it might be, you probably have sold your organic chemistry textbook. I guess maybe I'm talking back in the days where they had textbooks. Nowadays, everything is on, you know, some sort of a tablet or something like that. But in those days, you probably have sold your organic chemistry textbook. Why? Because it's not something you're going to return back to. There's nothing prompting you to do that, with the exception of extracting information. Once you've done that, you're done. Poetry is not like that. Poetry is something that when you read it, you want to go back to it because it signifies something very deep. And there's something about the poem that you go back to it again and again because it gives you a type of pleasure. That, again, we were talking about beauty giving the person a type of pleasure that isn't this visceral, sensual pleasure, yet it is a type of pleasure. So I have a poem up here from Emily Dickinson, and I'd like us to really just read it and reflect upon it because I thought it was very powerful. So Emily Dickinson writes, she says, "Hope is the thing with feathers." To really just ponder upon this. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul, that sings the tune without words and never stops at all. You know, you think about something like hope and the concept of hope that she's now given it this physical, she's anthropomorphized hope, right? She's made it into something physical, right? Which is this bird. And there's a certain beauty about that. So hope is a thing with feathers that perches in the soul, that sings the tune without words and never stops at all. The sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm. Oof. You know, when you think about the vicissitudes of life and the thing that's getting you through, it's that hope, right? And sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chilliest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. So I don't know if you've experienced that, but I personally found this very profound, something that you would go back and perhaps read again, just because there was information in a sense that was conveyed, but there was something that transcended the information. There was something that was more, that was something that was beautiful about it. And it had a deep meaning related to this concept of hope, right? I mean, everyone goes through the vicissitudes of life, the ups and downs, and experiences either hope or a lack of hope. And when you read this, it's very powerful. So when we talk about beauty being connected to meaning, we're saying that it points to something deeper. And one of the examples here is when we compare prose, simple kind of information transfer or just gaining information, versus poetry. All right, there's one other element related to poetry that I wanted to touch upon. That has to do with content and form, right? So when we think about poetry, you have the poem itself and the structure of the poem. In other words, there were certain words that the author put together in a very specific structure that allow the person to taste or sense or experience the beauty. When that form is broken, or that form is done away with, that element of beauty can be lost, okay? And a lot of times it happens when we talk about translation. You translate a poem from one language to the other, there's going to be a certain loss that is felt. And so now we come to the concept of content versus form. There's the actual content of the poem, and then there's the form. And where beauty comes in is related to the form and the content. And when these two are separated, this becomes problematic because it then loses the aspect of beauty, or it could lose the aspect of beauty. So you have a poem here from the man who was known as the poet of the East, right? Muhammad Iqbal, rahimahullah, in his poem, Baal Jibril, right? Or Gabriel's Wing. He says, and this poem is in Urdu, so for those of you who speak Urdu or know Urdu, you may be able to say, I'm not going to read the whole thing, But the poem starts off, kafir hai musliman to na shahi na fakiri, right? So if a Muslim is a kafir, right? If a Muslim is a non-Muslim, then there is neither kingship nor poverty. Now, the thing that I want us to note is that you find that there's a few words in the first phrase in Urdu, which then you need a lot more words in English to explain, in a sense, the particular verse that I just read, okay? But the verse in Urdu actually has a certain type of beauty, a certain cadence, a certain rhythm by the words that the poet put together in a way that the English doesn't. Because the English almost sounds, you know, empty, right? If a Muslim is a kafir, then there is neither kingship nor poverty. But if he is a mu'min, then he rules even in poverty. And if he's a kafir, then he relies on the sword and so on and so forth. And then when you compare that to mu'min hai to karta hai fakiri mein bhi shahi. But if he's a mu'min, then he rules even in poverty. He's equating this person who's a true believer, that it doesn't, you know, that even when he's in a state of poverty, in fact, he has this type of kingship, he has this type of royalty, and so on and so forth. The point I'm trying to make here is the idea of separating content and form, and this happens a lot when we go into translations, okay? Now, can a poem be contained in a paraphrase? Can you put a poem in a separate set of words or translate a poem? Clenneth Brooks, he talks about this idea of the heresy of paraphrase, which ties in with the last point I was making. And he has a few points where he says that there's a certain heresy, there's a certain no-no when it comes to trying to paraphrase a poem. And here's why. Number one, poetry can express several thoughts at the same time. Whereas when you try to translate it or you try to paraphrase it, you're not going to have the same effect. Poems can be polysemous, right? Meaning is conveyed on several levels. So when we looked at the poem related to hope, there are a number of levels that were conveyed as part of the poem, which when you try to paraphrase it, get lost. Meaning is lost in any paraphrase, right? To be or not to be, so on and so forth. That's the example that he gave. So when you try to paraphrase it, or let's say the extreme form of paraphrasing would be translating, you're going to have certain meanings that are lost, all right? And meanings meaning, specifically here, we're talking about the idea of beauty pointing towards meaning. Number four, sound is important. How many times have you heard a poem that when it's recited in a certain gathering, or it's got a certain rhyme or a certain structure or a certain cadence, that when it's explained, it doesn't have the same cadence, it doesn't have the same beauty. And so sound is important. And so we find that the idea of trying to paraphrase a poem becomes problematic, because then in essence you're kind of stripping away the concept of beauty itself. All right. Now, remember I said we were going to return back, and I know I'm running out of time here, but remember I said we're going to return back to the idea of subjective versus objective, okay? Is beauty part of the super rational? Is it something that's part of our meta language? That when you think about human work, beauty that's created by human beings, whether that be poetry, whether that be a painting, whether that be some sort of photography, filmography, whatever it might be, that there's going to be a certain bias. So just like there are cognitive biases when it comes to the human being, there's going to be certain artistic biases, for lack of a better term, when it comes to the human being as well. And that's why you can have a degree of subjectivity when it comes to art that's produced by a human being, right? Human beings, and we're going to enter into some area of theology now, from an Islamic worldview framework, human beings are not perfect beings. They're created beings, and hence they have limitations. And because of those limitations, those things that are produced by the human beings are also going to be subject to limitations. Whereas perfection is for God alone. And so when it comes to the natural world, this is where now we can say that we can experience objective beauty. All right. Why? Because nature is unbiased. Now, both of them in this diagram are pointing towards meaning. When you look at a poem, you're asking, what is the meaning of the person that composed the poem? What is the meaning in terms of what they think about me? Remember the dining table and things like that. But at the same time, we could apply the same idea when it comes to the natural world. All right. And this is something that while, you know, that when we say that nature is unbiased, this is, I would say, true no matter what your worldview is, no matter what your paradigm is, whether you're coming from an Islamic paradigm or any paradigm. And we see this even in our day-to-day, right? Because when you, let's say, bias a type of cereal, one of the things that marketers understand very well is that they slap a nice all-natural label on it. Well, why do they do that? Well, the reason is because something within inside ourselves points to the idea that if it's natural, if it's part of nature, nature is unbiased. Nature doesn't have cognitive biases. And so if it's natural, it's something that we should incline towards. We naturally incline towards it, right? And so that inclination, marketers understand very well. So if you have a type of cereal that's all natural, that's going to be better than a processed sugar-filled cereal, even though both of them are probably processed, but that's besides the point, right? But you understand that, and we understand that even when we look at the world around us. Now, let's take a look at the experience of natural beauty. So what you see there is a painting of the Niagara Falls, all right? So if you've ever visited the Niagara Falls, it is breathtaking, and it is just amazing. The Canada side, maybe not so much the American side, but anyway, it's breathtaking. Now, here's a painting of the Niagara Falls. And so one of the things that we can see right away is that when we look at the painting, there is a framing that's going on. When you think about the Niagara Falls, if you've ever visited it, you find that there's no concept of framing. Your direct experience, it's like there's no end from one end to another. You're just taking it all in. Someone that's painting the Niagara Falls or taking a picture of the Niagara Falls is going to be limited by the frame, and therefore there's going to be a limitation. And so depending on the person and the frame that they've chosen, again, the human side coming in, you could either experience that beauty or not. But being at the Niagara Falls and just seeing the vastness of the Niagara Falls itself, this is a different phenomenon altogether. This is something that touches much deeper within the human being. These are two very different experiences. So you find the painting, you find the fact that it is framed, and the fact that there is a certain bias depending on the choice of the person who's doing the painting. Okay, so when the experience of natural beauty, you find the painting, picture, there's framing, there's a human angle and a bias. The natural world itself, it's vast, open, and endless. There's no human angle or bias. It's direct, right? You're directly experiencing that the experience of beauty, right? It's not contained, right? It's not contained in a certain frame or a certain area. Rather, it's vast. And here's the other thing, which is really phenomenal, is that if you go to somewhere like the Niagara Falls or let's say Mount Cook, if you've ever been to New Zealand, and it's a beautiful mountain pass, and it's just gorgeous. It makes you feel small, like looking up at the night sky. And that's a very interesting phenomenon because on one hand, you're experiencing the beauty, let's say, of the mountain or of the falls, but at the same time, you have this type of fear. Now, I'm kind of using the word fear here a bit loosely. We in English, we call it awe, right? The experience that you have when you see it's awe. So in a sense, it's combining beauty and combining fear kind of at the same time. And it's a difficult experience to verbalize, to put into words, right? So if someone says, have you seen the Niagara Falls? You just got to go there and check it out yourself, right? Okay. So let's talk a little bit about awe, and then I'll conclude. Inshallah, because I know we are running short on time. So Michelle Sciotta and Dacher Keltner, at the University of California, Berkeley, they've done a lot of work and research in the idea and the concept of awe. So when they wanted to define awe, they said awe has been defined as an emotional response to perceptually vast stimuli that overwhelm current mental structures yet facilitate attempts at accommodation. I think that's a pretty good definition, right? If we're going to try to put the concept of awe into words. Now, through their studies, you know, Michelle Sciotta and Dacher Keltner, some of the work that they've done, they came to certain conclusions. So one of the conclusions when it comes to experiencing awe, the conclusion they came to was that it leads to decreased ego and heightened cognition. All right. Now let's stop for a second. We started this conversation. We started this session with how can we know truth as truth? And one of the things is that the thesis that I had put forth was that that the more a person experiences beauty, the more they see truth as truth. In the studies that they did, they found that when a person was exposed to the natural world, it led to a state of awe. And what were the results of being exposed or experiencing a state of awe? It was heightened cognition and a decreased ego. So they were less self-centered and more charitable. And we'll get into, well, I don't know if we have the time, but we'll try to touch upon some of the studies. And one of the things they experienced is that when they were put to test, when they were given cognitive tests, they found that experiencing awe led to a heightened cognition. Now, one of the things is that when it comes to when a person's going to accept the truth, these are two things that can block a person from the truth. A, not being able to understand it properly, a lowered cognition, and that's pretty clear. But the other thing that blocks a person from the truth can be their own ego and arrogance, right? From an Islamic worldview, we see that, you know, that these are two key areas in which a person can be blocked from the truth. So the hadith here from Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiallahu anhu said, the Prophet said, no one will enter paradise who has an Adam's weight of arrogance in his heart. And the man said, what if a man likes his clothes to look good and his shoes to look good? So the Prophet then says, Allah is beautiful and he loves beauty. Allahu al-jameel wa yuhibbul jamal, right? Inna Allah al-jameel wa yuhibbul jamal. So he says, Allah is beautiful and he loves beauty. Al-kibru batrul haq wa ghamtun nas. That kibr, arrogance, is rejecting the truth and looking down upon people, right? And why do you look down upon people? Well, it's because of arrogance, right? It's because of, you know, that's why you look down upon, you think that you're better than them. So what's interesting about this particular narration is that there's a juxtaposition between beauty and arrogance, which I think is really fascinating. Right, that you have this concept of beauty and so on and so forth, and it being juxtaposed with the concept of arrogance. Now, let's get into some of the studies. One of the studies that was done, and I'll try to cover these as quick as possible, inshallah, was a study of the effect on cognition. So what they did is they exposed people to various natural phenomena, right? Whether that was mountains or nature in some way. And then they would have the participants listen to a story for about 5 minutes. Now, the story was about a romantic dinner, and these people went out, and it gets into some details. You know, the guy was wearing a black tuxedo. The woman was wearing a dress. You know, the waiter came and yada, yada, yada. Okay, it goes into this whole story 5 minutes. And then at the end, the participant was asked, was there a candle on the table? Now, one of the things is that as human beings, we take certain cognitive shortcuts. We use these cognitive shortcuts to kind of fill in the gaps, all right? So when you think about a romantic dinner, you may, by way of like certain, by way of your cognition, you may assume there's a candle on the table because of what you already know about romantic dinners. In this story, there wasn't one. So I'm forgetting the term now. They're called, it'll come back to me, inshallah. Astaghfirullah. All right. So those cognitive shortcuts that are taken kind of place a candle on the table. Now, the people that were subject to the natural world, in other words, they were experiencing awe, they answered the correct, they answered correctly that there was no candle more often than people who were not subject to awe, right? So you have this, the first study, script relevant false items. Was there a candle on the table? Correct answer is no. Those people that experienced awe, you see on the graph there that they answered it correctly more often than those who were neutral, or not exposed to awe. All right, awe awakens the mind. All right, so now we're looking at various emotions. So when someone is in a state of awe, they did that by exposing people to nature. When they were in a state of enthusiasm, contentment, pride, awe won out 100% of the time when it came to cognition and sharpening and heightening one's cognition. All right, what about ego? So in the studies that they were done, what they came to the conclusion was that when people experience awe, they go from self-interest to collective interest. So they stop thinking, they think less of themselves and more about the general populace. From isolated self to integrated self, they started thinking, as opposed to them thinking of themselves as individuals, they started to think of themselves as a community. And it broke, and there was a breakdown of the us versus them thinking. Again, it's from the same study. So awe diminishes the ego. And the study that they did is they had people draw themselves in relation to the environment that they're in. So one place where they had people do this, excuse me, was a fisherman's wharf in San Francisco. Now, this is a place where it's a lot of people, it's the city center. So when people are drawing themselves, they drew themselves much bigger in relation to the city and the landscape, the cityscape that they're drawing around them. Yet when they were taken up to the mountains and they were asked to draw themselves, they drew themselves much smaller as compared to the landscape that they were drawing, right? So they saw themselves as smaller in the natural landscape as opposed to seeing themselves as being much bigger in the cityscape, right? Now, obviously, they did other tests and other questions related to, you know, what do you think about charity and other people and so on and so forth as part of this study. And what they found is that it decreases one's ego. What's really interesting is in the Islamic paradigm, the word for ego is kibr, which comes from kabir, to be big. So when you think of yourself as big, it's the word in Arabic for ego or arrogance, rather. And one of the interesting things is that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said the people who had the most ego on the day of judgment will be like ants and people will be stepping on them, meaning they falsely thought of themselves as big, and on the day of judgment, there's a physical manifestation of being the exact opposite of that, being the smallest thing, which is ants, and being stepped on. Anyhow, so awe amplifies humility, awe in the small self. The subjects were asked to draw themselves in the cosmopolitan environment. We just talked about that. Perceptions of vastness, humility, and we'll hopefully publish these slides a little bit. So what was the central thesis? The central thesis was the greater your exposure to beauty, the greater your ability to see truth as it really is. That doesn't mean that you're going to stop thinking and not use, you know, your cognitive senses, or you're not going to stop, you're not going to use your rationality. But now we understand that when a person wants to reach truth, they need to engage with not only engage on a level of rationality, but in addition to that, they need to engage with the natural world and engage with beauty, right, as an experience. And one of the things that, you know, perhaps the next part of this presentation would be how does that relate to the revelation, i.e. the Quran, from the Islamic paradigm, right? So you have here, related to the Quran, the Quran gives what we call signs or ayat. And they're always pointing, a lot of times they're pointing, not all the time, but they're pointing towards a natural world. And so you have Angelica Newworth, in her foreword on this book, the Quran, the Aesthetics of Pre-Modern Arabic Prose, she has a really interesting statement. She says, it is in the end, the pagan's verdict from Surat al-Qamar, the verdict of his sihr al-bayan, his transformation of the world into a sign system transcending empirical reality. Very interesting. That is allowed to epitomize the Quran's hermeneutical achievement. And it goes back to this idea that the Quran is constantly pulling you and asking us to reflect upon the natural world. And there's a reason for that. Because when we do that, we're getting closer and closer to the truth, right? And by extension, I'm going to basically have to finish it off here. By extension, when a person goes down that route, engages with the Quran, engages with what the Quran is instructing the person to do, they'll find that in the end, they're able to see truth as truth. Truth being not only a rational, not being only limited to rationality, but having other means by which to get to it in addition to rationality. So those means could be exposure to beauty. They could be spiritual by way of having certain spiritual acts like calling out to God and other things, other phenomenological areas and, thinking deeply about things and so on and so forth, which is outside the scope of what we're talking about in this particular presentation. But hopefully the thesis that I was trying to present, and that was that beauty leads to truth. Hopefully we've substantiated that in some one way or another, and it'll allow you, the one who's listening to this presentation, to kind of explore this area a bit more on your own by way of the Quran is what I would encourage, and just by spending more time in nature. So I'll go ahead and stop there. We'll open up for some questions. I know we've been going on for a little while, so let's see what we got. Okay. All right. Wow. Okay. Wow. There's a lot of comments. So if you have questions, go ahead and post them. We'll take them for another maybe 7 to 8 minutes, I think. Maybe another 10 minutes if we need to. All right, so most of the questions have to do with my electricity going out. So, where'd he go? What happened? But if you do have questions, go ahead and post them now so I can take a look at them. And if you don't, then that's fine too. All right. Okay. Let's see. All right, well, I don't really see any questions unless I'm missing something. We got some questions for Pondering Soul, so I'll let him handle those questions on his own. Yeah, nothing. So if you have anything related to the topic, go ahead and post them. If not, okay, so here's a good question. How to prove you must obey God? So I'm hoping that one of the things that we've transcended is the idea of having to prove everything, right? Now, I'm not saying that we can't prove it. I'm just saying that this sort of mindset about having to prove every single question, that we want to kind of not jump right into that scenario and say, okay, well, I've got to find a way to prove it, right? That being said, when it comes to the idea of obeying God, it starts with the idea of believing in God. And what is your concept of God? Because if we believe that indeed God is the creator of everything, he is al-Khaliq, then it links to his worship. If it's true that he created you and he knows, right, he has knowledge of everything, then the things that he has commanded by, just as a simple kind of, we understand this logically, that you should then submit to God and obey God because, A, he knows more than you, right? He has knowledge that is vast. He is maximally perfect in his knowledge. Similarly, he is also al-bar. He is the good. He is ar-Rahman. So he wants good for you. So it's not like, okay, so if you know about God, you would mistrust God or anything like that. And so when we start to study who Allah is, that in and of itself would lead a person to obeying God. Every single person, and this is part of our fitrah, which as we come up with, as we'll be talking about in other series, every person, part of their fitrah is the need to worship, the need to love something and submit to something. That's part and parcel of our constitution, of our fitrah, right? Now that worship can either be directed towards Allah or it can be directed towards something else. So you will either love Allah or you'll love yourself, your money, your spouse, right? And I'm not saying you don't love those things, but obviously the love of Allah comes before all of that, okay? So worship is part and parcel of our fitrah. We have a need to worship. The question is, who is worthy of worship? Is if I'm submitting and to myself and I have love for myself, but I'm a limited being. I have cognitive biases, right? I have limitations. So am I really truly worthy of submitting to myself? Am I truly the one that I should love more than anyone else? Of course, we're talking here of love from the perspective of ego, right? Or is that love and that submission due to the one that's worthy of that? So hopefully that answered that. Okay, if you try to, so someone mentioned, I don't know if there's a comment, if you try to point out the beauty of this world, how the sky looks on a dark sky, even from a micro perspective, how gigantic Allah has made space, they respond, yes, it is all scientific. Yeah, that's one of the issues, right? One of the fact that we live in the modern world where science has been taken to be a type of holy grail in which that, you know, if it doesn't make sense scientifically or you can't quote unquote prove something scientifically, then it becomes invalid. And the reality is that while science, again, can give us a lot of benefit, but there are certain questions that science can't answer. Metaphysical questions. Science deals with the physical world. Metaphysical questions are outside of the scope of science. So there are certain questions that science just can't deal with, right? Science has its limitations. You know, and so what I'll recommend is that if you know, there's a section in the book by Hamza Zortzis, The Divine Reality, which speaks about this, and you know, has science disproven God? I highly recommend you take a look through it and go through it. Okay. How can we know that our fitrah is not clouded? Because for many people nowadays, indoctrinated to liberalism and belief as an axiom. So if the majority they've deceived easily. Okay, so I'm going to try to answer the first part of the question. This is where revelation comes in, right? And one of the things that we understand is that there are certain things that are part of our fitrah, but when it comes to some of the details, this is where revelation enhances our fitrah and we're able to have a clear idea of what is correct and versus what is incorrect, right? There's a very interesting hadith of the Prophet ﷺ where he mentions that that there is like a path, if I'm remembering the hadith correctly, that there's a path and on both sides of this path are two walls and there are doors on these walls that have curtains upon them. And there is a voice that's calling from the top and a voice that's calling from the end. And these walls are the limits of Allah, the hudud of Allah, the place where you're not supposed to transcend. You're not supposed to go, you're not supposed to transgress these limits, right? You're going to enter into the haram. And each one of these has a door. And every time a person goes towards one of these doors and tries to open the curtain, a voice says, stop, stop, keep moving forward. All right? Now, that voice, the Prophet ﷺ ascribed it. So that motivation for moving forward on that path, which the Prophet ﷺ described as the Sirat al-Mustaqim, the straight path, one of those voices is the voice inside of each and every single believer. And the objective at the end and the voice at the end, the Prophet ﷺ described that as the Quran. And so when we go to, like for instance, Ayatul Nur, Allahu Nuru Samawati wal Ard, and we analyze the tafsir of that, it ends off by saying, Nurun ala Nur. The nur, the light of the fitrah, coupled with the light of revelation. That is the thing that we're able to move forward with and have this type of cognitive, psycho-spiritual stability. Otherwise, you won't know because of the environment that you're in what is truly natural versus what you should or should not be doing, etc. So I hope I answered that. We'll go ahead and stop there. I think that's the last one we have, the last question we can deal with. So with that said, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless everyone. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept everyone's coming to this session, bearing with the electricity going out. It's raining quite hard here in Houston. So I appreciate your patience. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you for that. May Allah accept all of your efforts, your deeds. And I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive me for any shortcomings. If there were any mistakes, anything that I said that was incorrect, or anything that I said was even offensive, then that is all from myself and from shaytan. Any sort of benefit that you may have received from this session, it is all from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Jazakumullah khair. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdik. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa ant. Astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.